following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
How should you respond to people who have harmed you? A couple Sundays ago, our nation, indeed the whole world, was treated to a stark contrast between two different answers to that question. One response represents the approach of those who take Jesus seriously. The other response represents how much of the rest of the world would answer that question. 2 weeks ago that night, millions of people watched as a 36-year-old mother and widow stood on a platform in a football stadium full of people and offered forgiveness to the gunman who had murdered her husband in front of her and her two small children. After she spoke, the President of the United States got up and offered his remarks. He said this, Charlie, talking about Charlie Kirk, did not hate his opponents. He wanted the best for them. That's where I disagreed with Charlie. I hate my opponent. I don't want the best for them. I'm sorry, Erica, but now Erica can talk to me and the whole group, and maybe they can convince me that's not right, but I can't stand my opponent. Now, to be fair, the president most likely was just being honest about his feelings after watching somebody he cared about, who he had a great friendship with, be shot down. It is extremely hard to forgive those who have caused you pain. In a way, his remarks were actually paying tribute to Erica Kirk's willingness to extend mercy towards her husband's assassin. However, his words also represent the default position for much of our world. There's something in us that just finds it much easier to hate our enemies than to love them. That seems to come naturally, doesn't it? Most of the world would agree that if you suddenly found those who had harmed you under your power, then what you need to do is just pound them into oblivion so they can never hurt you again. However, Jesus calls those who have come to believe in him to follow a different path. If we've truly come to know God through Christ, like we claim, if we've truly been adopted into God's family, if we truly want to be people after God's own heart, then we're called to respond differently than the rest of the world by offering mercy and forgiveness to those who've hurt us. And let's not kid ourselves. This path of mercy and forgiveness is a very hard one to walk. You might say that retribution and revenge represent the broad highway that most of the world follows, while mercy and forgiveness represent the narrow and difficult road that actually leads to life and salvation. Mercy and forgiveness are not just a New Testament thing either. We have a great example of this approach in the life of David, the man who would go on to become Israel's greatest king, as it's recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 24, which we're going to walk our way through this morning. It's also described in 1 Samuel chapter 26 because David follows the exact same process just about in another encounter. We're not going to cover that too much today, but I put it on there so you could go and read it for yourself and read the two side by side and see that this was something that was pretty consistent in David's character. But let's walk our way through this passage and see what we can learn from David's example. The first lesson I want you to note here is this. David resisted the urge for exacting revenge. And let's look at 1 Samuel 24, verses 1 through 4. Now when Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, saying, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the rocks of the wild goats. He came to the sheepfolds on the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave. The men of David said to him, "Behold, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I'm going to give you your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as seems good to you.'" Then David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly. So what we see here happening is Saul received word that David and his band of outlaws were hiding out in the wilderness of En-Gedi. That's near the Dead Sea. They call it the Dead Sea for a good reason. Nothing lives in it and not much lives around it. The area around the Dead Sea is a rocky desert characterized by these huge craggy cliffs that are full of caves. They're full of ravines. There's lots of places for a band of outlaws to hide. En-Gedi is an oasis located in that wilderness. It's a freshwater spring that runs all the time. It is still there. You can still visit it. I don't recall if I had a chance to visit En-Gedi when I was there nearly 30 years ago, but I know we passed by that area, and it is located in one of the most miserable places on planet Earth. It's so dry in that region. When we were traveling in that region, our guide had to remind us every 15 minutes to drink water. Because it is so arid there. And this was in November, okay? So you just think it might be a little cooler. But it's so dry, and you don't realize it's so dry that the water just gets sucked out of you through your sweat. And so we had to, every 15 minutes, he'd set his watch to beep, and we'd have to remember to drink some water. David and his men are hiding out in that kind of wilderness. And so Saul mustered 3,000 of his best soldiers. He said, these are chosen men from throughout the land of Israel. So these are the crack troops. And they set out to hunt David down. And Saul's regiment came to a set of sheepfolds, places where shepherds could rest their sheep. They had walls set up so the sheep would be secure. And there was likely forage and fresh water nearby. So it was a great place to take a pit stop. They didn't have Buc-ee's in those days. So Saul decides while he's there, there's a cave. And so he goes in to make a pit stop. That explains why Saul's bodyguards did not go with him into the cave. There's just some things a man has got to take care of on his own. So he walks into this cave, and out of all the caves in that area, Saul just happened to choose the one cave where David and his men happened to be hiding. And so Saul is in this vulnerable position, completely unaware of David's presence, and David's men are like, boss, this is it. You can solve all of our problems right now. Just while he's got his back turned and he's not paying attention, just strike him down and we can all go home. I mean, isn't this what God told you? And there's some debate over whether, you know, this line they give him about God promising to deliver his enemies this way. We don't have a record of that in 1 Samuel. So it may be they were making this up on the spot, as people do, because they really, really wanted to go home. But David thought about it for a second. David crept up behind Saul, but instead of plunging his sword into Saul's back, he quietly sliced off a piece of Saul's cloak. David did win a mighty battle that day, but it wasn't the battle against Saul. It was the battle against himself. Because the most natural thing in the world for us to do is to strike our enemies when they're down. Chuck Swindoll said this in his book on this, on David's life. If you ever want to test the carnality of a person, ask him or her what you should do when your enemy is vulnerable. Unless they are men or women of God, they will tell you to strike every time. Because that's what comes natural. But it's not necessarily what honors God. Proverbs 25, verses 21 through 22 tell us, if your enemy's hungry, give him food to eat. Excuse me? If he's thirsty, give him water to drink, for you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. We're called to do the right thing by our enemies. David learned not to exact revenge. David also persuaded others to keep the peace. In verse 5, it came about afterwards that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. So he said to his men, far be it from me, because of the Lord, that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed. David persuaded his men with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. And Saul arose, left the cave, and went on his way. So even slicing off the edge of David's cloak bothered David's conscience, because despite all the horrible things that Saul had done to him, Saul was still the legitimate king of Israel. Just like David, Saul had been selected and anointed for leadership by God. That hadn't changed. It was not David's place to remove Saul. That was God's business. Okay? God's the one that raised him up. God needed to be the one that took him out. So by his actions, if he had actually killed Saul, he would have been in danger of acting like the rebel Saul had accused him of being. See, God has established authority. And as people of God, we need to respect that authority. Now, hear me out here, okay? I want to be very careful about this. I have heard preachers misuse this concept to terrible, terrible result, okay? Just because you have authority does not give you the right to abuse that authority. And if you abuse that authority, you need to be held accountable. And sure enough, Saul was guilty of abusing that authority. But David saw it as God's place to take care of Saul, not his. David had all these men, though, that were loyal to him. They were his posse. And I'm sure some of them were like, boss, if you don't want to do it, let me take care of it, okay? Just let me take care of this for you. So David used his influence to keep his own men from attacking Saul themselves. Now, it's only natural when somebody's hurt you, you know, you got a choice. You can either keep all that bottled up inside and it's going to eat at your soul like an acid. Or you can find some trusted people to share that with to help you process it. Okay, it's only natural to go to loyal friends and to vent our frustrations about other people with them. Okay, however, we need to be careful that as we share our burdens with other people, we are not encouraging them to take matters into their own hands. In 12th century England, King Henry II was locked in a bitter dispute with Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And King Henry is reported to have complained to some of his courtiers, "Who will rid me of this troublesome priest?" So guess what happened? Four Henry's knights took it upon themselves to go track down the Archbishop of Canterbury and kill him. That may have gotten rid of the troublesome priest, but it didn't get rid of the problem. In fact, it only made things worse. It turned Becket into a public hero. It undermined Henry's reign with his own subjects. And it also caused a big rift between King Henry and the Pope that persisted for years. One of the lessons that good leaders learn, often the hard way, is that some people are not loyal enough. But some people can actually be a little too loyal, okay? And I thank God for people who've been friends to me and given me a support and a shoulder to cry on sometimes. But I've learned that sometimes you got to be careful, because if you say the wrong thing to the wrong person, they may go out and try to make it better. And sometimes that can just make things worse, okay? I got a friend who every time he sees me says, "Hey, everybody treating you okay? Do I need to go talk to anybody?" And I appreciate that so much. I love that brother. I hope he understands that. And this is not about him. I'm not dissing him, but he's always been a good friend. But sometimes you, as a leader, you got to be careful, because you can actually, you know, it's tempting to send out your surrogates, but that's not right. And so share your struggles with trusted friends. But be careful about what you share and how you share it. The goal should be to de-escalate the problem, not pour kerosene on it. All right, you get me? As Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. Yeah, some of y'all are ahead of me there. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. I mean, think about what God's done for us. He has reconciled us to himself, the rebels to the king, through his son Jesus. Our God's a peacemaking God. And if we want to truly reflect his character, we will be peacemakers as well. David also humbly confronted the man who harmed him. Verse 8. Now afterward, Saul's already left the cave, David arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, saying, "My Lord, the king!" And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself. So after Saul left the cave and had traveled a safe distance away, David finally revealed himself. Now, note that David did not challenge Saul belligerently. Okay? He professed his loyalty. "My Lord!" He respected Saul's proper title, the king. And then he showed the proper respect. He actually got down on his knees, bowed down, and then lay flat out to show respect for the king of Israel. It takes a lot of self-control to show respect for somebody who's disrespected you. But David did it. David was determined to let the fault lie with Saul, not with his own actions. So much of our politics and public conversation today is characterized by posturing and displays of toughness. Never let them see you sweat, right? Displays of belligerence often poison our interactions, and they prevent us from reaching the results we desire. Proverbs 15:1 tells us this: a gentle answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up wrath. But so often, what's our first instinct? Somebody disrespects you, right back in their face. God tells us the path of wisdom is take a deep breath, let it out slow, and show respect, even to those who've disrespected us, to practice self-control. There's actually a local politician, I'm not going to tell you who it is, but he told me this, it's always stuck with me. He says, you know, I've learned that when I go to Nashville, I always get more results when I show up with a bouquet of flowers than a bag of hammers. You know, and I found that's usually true as well. You know, the old saying, you get more flies with honey than vinegar, right? But at the same time, you don't have to act like a doormat, but you always need to honor decorum and show proper respect. Someone who wants to impress you with their toughness is usually betraying their sense of insecurity. It takes a lot more strength to practice self-control. Showing proper respect places you in the position of true strength. David also declared the truth of the offense. Pick up in verse 9, David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men saying, 'Behold, David seeks to harm you. Behold, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord has given you today into my hand in the cave.' And some said to kill you, but my eye had pity on you. And I said, 'I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' Now, my father, see the edge of your robe in my hand. For in that I cut off the edge of your robe and did not kill you, know and perceive there is no evil or rebellion in my hands. And I have not sinned against you, though you are lying in wait for my life to take it." In the passage, what do we see? We see David respectfully but honestly laying out the case that he had not sought to harm Saul, even though Saul had been intent on harming him. Now, one of the common misconceptions about forgiveness is that forgiveness requires us to ignore the fact that evil's been committed, okay? That, you know, we just got to smile and pretend that, you know, kiss and make up, nothing, you know, nothing really happened. We just carry on like normal, right? On the contrary, biblical forgiveness, genuine forgiveness, is based on truth. Okay, it doesn't deny the truth, it asserts the truth. And that includes truthfully acknowledging the harm that someone has caused you. And note that David spoke the truth directly to the one who had harmed him. He didn't go around speaking it to everybody else. That's another thing we're tempted to do, right? We go around and we don't go to the person we have the problem with. We talk to everybody else about it. You know, here's one thing I've learned. Somebody that'll talk to you about somebody will also talk about you to somebody. And that doesn't solve the problem. It only spreads it around. It stokes our ego, but it doesn't really heal things. If you want to find healing and reconciliation, you need to go to the person where the fault lies, or at least where you perceive the fault lies. You need to talk directly and respectfully to them. David went and addressed Saul. He did not sugarcoat it. He said, "You've been trying to kill me." But that leads us to the next lesson. David practiced forgiveness. Verse 12. "May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge me on you. But my hand shall not be against you." This statement right here in verse 12 gets to the heart of what true biblical forgiveness is all about. David didn't deny that Saul had sought to harm him. Instead, David invoked the Lord to act as a judge between the two men, and David committed himself to not treating Saul as Saul had treated him. "Saul, you may have tried to kill me, but I am not going to raise my hand against you. You're God's problem. I am going to turn you over to him. I'm not going to take matters into my own hands." True biblical forgiveness does not deny that someone has done harm, but it commits itself not to do harm in return. We see this throughout the scriptures. Romans 12:19, Paul says, friends, do not avenge yourselves. Remember, these are people that are getting a lot of flack in the city of Rome for trying to follow Jesus. And he says, don't avenge yourselves. Instead, leave room for God's wrath. Because it is written, vengeance belongs to me. I will repay, says the Lord. When we take vengeance into our own hands, we are stealing something that rightfully belongs to God. I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound like a very safe move to me. Okay? In contrast, what does Jesus teach us? Jesus says, I tell you, don't resist an evildoer. On the contrary, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other one to him also. In other words, don't strike back, but remain, I'm not going to say remain vulnerable, but you don't take your own vengeance. See, the world is by two rules. Do unto others as they have done unto you, only twice as hard. Or do unto others before they do unto you. See, that's the way the world operates. But if we are followers of Jesus, that is not the way we are called to operate. And Jesus tells us this, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Love your neighbor as yourself. That's it. To do otherwise is to deny Jesus. David also refused to get on his enemy's level. Verse 13. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. Or after whom has the king of Israel come out? Who are you pursuing? A dead dog? A single flea? So David quoted what apparently was a well-known proverb then, that out of the wicked comes forth wickedness. We might say it like this, wicked is as wicked does. Jesus put it like this, you shall know them by their fruits. See, David implied that Saul was the one who was acting wickedly towards him. But also David said, I'm not going to reciprocate. Despite committing to take the high road, David avoided portraying himself as morally superior to Saul. See, sometimes we play that game too. Well, you know, I'm not going to stoop to that level. We try to position ourselves as somehow better than the person who has harmed us. David took the opposite approach. He compared himself to a single flea on a dead dog. Now, some of y'all know how I feel about dogs. I got two dogs. I love them. Enjoy working with them and watching them become good citizens and all that stuff. But the ancient Israelites did not share my love for dogs. In ancient Israel, dogs were unclean scavengers. You know, they were the ones who went through your trash. You wanted to avoid dogs at all costs. And so a dead dog was about the most worthless thing that an ancient Hebrew could imagine. And David is saying, I am not even worth as much as that dead dog. I'm lower than a flea off that dog's corpse. So he was, again, claiming he was not even worth Saul's time to hunt down. There's an old proverb from our time, don't ever wrestle with a pig. You only get covered with mud and the pig's going to enjoy it. You will never regret taking the high road, but you will regret allowing yourself to get dragged down to the abuser's level. So what did David do instead? David entrusted his situation to the Lord. Verse 15, the Lord therefore be judge and decide between you and me, and may he see and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand. Practicing biblical forgiveness is an act of faith. All right, you get that? Yeah, this is not normal. This is not easy. This is hard. And the only way you're going to do this, if you set out to do this, is to do it with the help of God. Practicing biblical forgiveness is an act of faith. When we forgive, we are saying we trust more in the Lord's ability to handle the wrongdoer than in our ability to do so. Sometimes it takes a lot of faith to let God handle situations, okay? However, I've learned from experience, I've said this before, the Lord seems to be a lot more creative and a lot more relentless in bringing people to justice than I am. And I've learned just to leave things like that in his hands. And here's what David does. He overcomes evil with good. Verse 16, when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, is this your voice, my son David? Sounds like a different tune from Saul, doesn't it? Saul lifted up his voice and wept. He said to David, you were more righteous than I, for you have dealt well with me, while I have dealt wickedly with you. You have declared today that you have done good to me, that the Lord delivered me into your hand, and yet you didn't kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? May the Lord therefore reward you with good in return for what you've done to me this day. When he realized just how close he had come to handing his life over to David, Saul had a moment of clarity. That's not Saul's strong suit, as we've been noticing through this study. Saul recognized David had treated him more righteously than he had treated David. And for a moment, Saul repented from all the grief he brought on David's life and resigned himself to his fate. I say for a moment, because if you know the spoiler alert here, in Saul's case, the repentance didn't stick. That's why we have 1 Samuel chapter 26. You can go read that story for yourself. But Saul's continued refusal to let go of his jealousy and hatred towards David would play a big role in his eventual downfall. When we suffer injustice and pain, sometimes it is hard to see how good can triumph ultimately. However, if we truly believe Jesus and we have faith in God's word, we have to accept that in the end, God will bring about true justice and restoration. He's going to do it in His time, His way. We may not ever even see it this side of heaven, but we have to leave that in His hands. And here's a big one right here. David showed grace to someone who didn't deserve it. Verse 20 through 22, Saul goes on, "Now behold, I know you will surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hand. Now swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and you will not destroy my name from my father's household." David swore to Saul. So Saul asked only one thing from David. He said, "David, I've been in the wrong. It's clear to me now, God's going to make you king one day. But here's what I want you to do. When you come to power, make me a promise. Do not do what is the expected thing in our culture, okay? Which is to wipe out all your predecessor's family so they won't be a future threat. Do me a favor, spare my family." Despite all the grief that Saul had caused David, guess what David did? He agreed. And as much as he could, David honored that promise until his death. But there's one other thing David did in this situation we need to learn from. David established healthy boundaries to protect himself. And Saul went to his home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. You know, sometimes we act as if extending forgiveness means we have to go along as if nothing happened, nothing wrong had ever happened, okay? Remember when we were kids and we get in a little tussle on the playground with somebody and we'd go up and complain to our parents, and they would usually, bring us and the other kid together and they say, "Okay, tell each other you're sorry, shake hands, now go play," right? Well, that works in a lot of situations with kids, but you and I know that as grown-ups, a lot of those situations are a lot more complicated, a lot more damaging, a lot more painful. You remember, you ever seen kids, brothers and sisters or siblings that were forced to wear the get-along shirt? The oversized shirt that they both got to wear so that if they, they're just like right together doing everything. That's fine for kids, but it didn't really work too well for adults. True forgiveness does not require us to unilaterally disarm and then act like a doormat. Sometimes, even as we commit ourselves to the path of forgiveness, we need to establish some safe boundaries to protect us from being harmed again. And even though Saul had acknowledged his wrongdoing, even though he said, "David, I'm wrong, you're right. You're going to be the next king. I see that now." David didn't go home. David recognized Saul was fickle and prone to slide back into his dangerous habits. And so as Saul and his regiment withdrew from En-Gedi, David and his men returned to their defensive positions. They established boundaries to protect themselves. It is okay to set appropriate boundaries to protect yourself from those who have shown a propensity to harm you. There's somebody here today that needs to hear that. It's okay. How do we follow the path of forgiveness when it seems like the rest of the world is so ready to take advantage of our refusal to seek retribution? How can we commit ourselves to the difficult path of overcoming evil with good? What possible motivation can we find to extend grace to somebody who doesn't deserve it? The answer is found in our faith in God. By faith, we have to accept that God is just and He's good, and that at some point in the future, He will make all things right. We also have to find the motivation to show grace to those who don't deserve it in the fact this is exactly what God has done for you and for me. Think about it. We were rebels. We were sinners. And even while we were still in rebellion against Him, our Heavenly Father sent his precious, unique son into this world to bear the weight of our sin, to remove the alienation between us and God, to make it possible for our sins to be forgiven, for us to be cleansed and made whole and brought back into fellowship with God. He didn't have to do it. What if God had acted the way most of us do towards the people that have harmed us? See, God shows grace to people who don't deserve it. He showed grace to me. He's offered grace to you too. If we truly understand the depth of what God has done for us, and we truly want to be people after God's own heart, how can we be any less towards those who have sinned against us?
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.